Hello and welcome to Learn With Us. Today on the show it's Max Stoiber. How's it going today,
buddy? Hey, how's it going?
Yes, good, thanks. As good as can be expected.
Yeah, this whole situation is kind of interesting, but trying to make the most of it.
So I met Max on React Vienna Slack group, and we've been like hanging out, having the odd coffee meeting, I guess, on virtually, which is kind of nice. And Max is a developer based in Austria and is the founder of Spectrum Chat.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. And right now, I work at Gatsby. So I founded Spectrum 2 years ago. Eventually, that got acquired by GitHub. And then recently, I left GitHub, and now I work at Gatsby on a bunch of React stuff, basically.
Nice. And how long was it after you started Spectrum that GitHub got in touch with you?
A year and a half, I think, maybe two. Something in that order of magnitude.
That must have been so exciting.
It was by far the most stressful time of my entire life. The whole acquisition process was probably the worst thing I've ever done. And it's because we spent 1.5 or 2 years building this product and trying to make it work. And we were sort of at the end of the road. We didn't have enough customers to sustain us, and also we couldn't raise another round of funding. So we were practically running out of money eventually. And GitHub approached us about potentially acquiring us. And we thought, wow, that's exciting. But the thing about acquisition processes is that it takes forever. And you have to provide a huge amount of information. Literally, you get questions every single day about this bit of metrics. You have to do interviews. You have to do all of these things. And every single time they ask you anything, they're like, what is your server setup? How much do you pay for service? How does your background job queue system work? And you get all these questions. And for every single one, you feel like it could be a deal breaker, because otherwise, why would they be asking the questions, right? Like they would only ask questions that are important. Yeah. And so it feels like you're getting these thousands of questions, and any single one of these questions could be a deal breaker that could make the entire thing fall through, but it's sort of your last chance. So you're trying to make everything go as well as possible, but it takes forever. It took us 3 months from beginning, or even longer, from beginning to talking to them to actually closing and joining GitHub. And those 3 months were so stressful. I'm generally a rather chill person. I'm not very stressed usually.
Yeah.
But that was the first time in my life where I really didn't sleep. I just could not sleep for many, many nights during those 3 months because I was so stressed. Is this going to work out? Are we going to join GitHub, or are we just going to fail entirely? Is that thing that I did going to make the entire acquisition fall through? Is the negotiation going the way we want it? Are all of these things going to work out? It was extremely stressful. I'm happy in hindsight that it happened. Of course, I'm glad I was at GitHub, but the acquisition process, wow, damn, that was really not fun.
Yeah, well, I've never done a startup properly, and so I mean, it would be a nice thing to happen to me one day. I'm quite excited just to have to get away from just doing the old paycheck thing, you know, when you've got guaranteed income and it's hard to like, okay, I'm just going to risk the next few months and years.
Yeah, it's a journey. It's definitely harder than people. I mean, everybody says it's hard, and it looks way easier from the outset than it actually is. It's really hard to build something that's successful.
What was it that gave you the initial idea to make Spectrum?
So Spectrum happened because my two co-founders, Brian Lovin and Bryn Jackson, had and still have a podcast network, actually, called SpecFM. And they have about 9 podcasts on there about various tech and design things. And these podcasts got quite big, and they had quite a vibrant community of designers and developers, super smart people, that they wanted to connect with each other. And so initially, they created a Slack group like most people do. And then that Slack group eventually grew to 8,000 or 9,000 members. And then a Slack employee approached them and went, hey, it's really cool what you're doing here with your podcast network, but we can't have 9,000 members in a free workspace. Either you start paying us or you have to move somewhere else. Essentially, they threatened them. And Bryn and Brian looked around, but didn't really like any of the other options. None of them really scale to 10,000 people chatting at the same time, right? You can't put that in Discord or Slack or Gitter or anywhere really. And so Spectrum was really just a platform for their own community at first. And funnily enough, they were using styled components and open source projects, which I created. And they reached out one day via Twitter DMs and said, "Hey, Max, we have this problem, which we think might be with styled components. Could you help us?" And I was like, yeah. At the time, I'd never met them in person, but I was a huge fan of their work and I listened to a couple of their podcasts. And I was like, yeah, if you just give me access to the code base, I'll take a look. And they added me to the code base and I looked at the code base and I was like, hold on, this is something I need for my open source communities. I want this to exist. I need this. Can we please make this a thing? And so from that, really, we then joined forces and built it into this reusable platform, because at the beginning, it was really just for the SpecFM network, which is also where the name came from. SpecFM was the podcast network, and then Spectrum, based on SpecFM, was supposed to be the community platform for SpecFM. And we just ran with that name and made it a more general platform for all communities to use.
So it sort of provides a search indexable thread-based chat that is more persistent than the likes of Discord or even Slack. Is that pretty much what it does?
Exactly. Yeah, you really nailed it there. It's threads that are search indexed, but then underneath the threads, sort of every single topic, basically, it's real time chat, and so you still get that feeling of chatting in real time, but it's much more manageable because you wake up to 10 new threads and not 1,000 new messages in a single stream, right? So it's a lot more manageable for community admins. It's a lot more scannable. And then, of course, search index, which means all this great content where people are helping each other can be found again. And it's not just lost in the void of Discord or Slack. Yeah, that was a theory, at least. We didn't really nail it. In hindsight, the product itself wasn't good enough. It's fine, and it's still growing like mad. Like, we're not working on it anymore, but it's still growing like mad. It's still super valuable. Lots of communities use it. But now that I look at it, I wish I could just spend 2 months rebuilding it from scratch, because there's so many things I do different. And it was a fine product, but I just wish we could do it again.
What would you make differently?
Well, the big problem was that, yes, we made communities more scalable, but we also lost a lot of the activity indicators. All the Spectrum communities, even though they might have 10,000 members and they're super active, they feel a lot less vibrant than equivalent Slack or Discord communities, because you're not waking up to 1,000 new messages, but you're waking up to 5 new threads. And we, at the end of, before we essentially got acquired, we were playing around with designs for a new community homepage that would showcase the activity that was happening. For example, like you have in Slack or Discord, notifications whenever a new member joins, right? Or whenever a new thread was posted, or when people were online. And we wanted sort of to show, we wanted a place to show all the activity that was happening without overwhelming people with having to dig through it, but instead they could then sort of select the pieces that they actually wanted to dig further into, if that makes any sense. The other thing that sort of isn't good enough about Spectrum is this concept of a sense of community. This is sort of a famous concept from lots of community research, where researchers judge communities based on how much of a sense of community they generate with their members. And Spectrum communities are too loose. They don't have the same tight sense of a community of Slack or Discord, because it's too easy to join them. Because once you have an account on Spectrum, you can join any community with a single click. And that's great on the one hand, because it makes joining a community really easy. But the downside of that is that it's almost too easy. It doesn't give the people this sort of this feeling of a membership like you have on Slack. Because Slack is kind of tedious to join, or even Discord, which is better to join, but still a little bit tedious. Because they're slightly tedious, you generate much more of a connection with the community, because everybody went through that same shared experience of having to create this stupid 100th Slack account. And it sounds really dumb, but that actually adds to the sense of community. And now Slack actually does that incidentally. They don't focus on this. They didn't do it on purpose. But it's something that we should have worked on more, right? I wish whenever somebody joined a community on Spectrum, what I would do now is I would have a join process where you have to essentially apply under air quotes to join a community. You have to say sort of who you are in the context of that community. So if I'm joining the React community, I can sort of add a description for myself that is specific to the React community. I can be like, I'm the creator of style components. I'm the creator of React Boilerplate. I now work at Gatsby. But if I join a coffee community, I can then add a different description. I can be like, I'm Max. I am a SCIE certified barista. I have an espresso machine at home and I make about 2 coffees every day, right? Or if I joined do you know what I mean? Like every single community, you sort of have a different context. And by adding that step in the middle, whenever you join a community where you have to introduce yourself and under air quotes, apply, even if the community admin doesn't have to approve you, you just join immediately. But if there's a sense of everybody going through this experience together and everybody sort of sharing something of themselves before they can actually get into the group, it generates much more of a sense of community. Those are some of the things I do differently now.
It makes perfect sense. With Discord, it's a bit easier than Slack because you just have to have one account and you have to have an invite link, whereas Slack, it's always the same old, oh, I've got to create a password and all this stuff. And you eventually just, you forget all your passwords and have to keep getting the magic link to sign in.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess it's more secure as well because it's like if one person gets access to it, then they don't get access to the whole lot.
Yeah, it's just a different use case, right? Like Slack is really focused on businesses. Helping businesses connect. And in that context, having separate accounts makes total sense. It's just for communities, that's not very useful.
Mm-hmm. So the other co-founders, were they technical as well?
So Bryn and Brian, they're 2 designers, but both of them also code. Brian more so than Bryn. Bryn did a bunch of our front-end work, but Brian really did full stack work together with me. I was the most technical, but really before we built Spectrum, I had no idea of backend development. It was my first time using Node.js in production. It was my first time using GraphQL. It was my first time actually running and operating a database in production. And we made a bunch of mistakes, but we made it work. And really, Brian and Bryn both, if they hadn't been technical, if they hadn't also programmed, there's no way we would have been able to make it work. Uh-huh.
So how do you get the various threads indexed by Google?
Every thread is sort of its own page. And that's really, all of them are just public. It's similar to Reddit, where when you post a post, it generates a new page, right?
Yeah.
And so on Spectrum, it's the same. You post a new topic and a new thread that you want to talk about, it generates a new page, and then whatever the comments are, they're just real-time chat. And obviously, the real-time chat gets indexed over time because Google doesn't crawl everything every single second. But overall, we have, I don't know how many, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of pages indexed. And like literally 80% or 90% of our growth ever has come from search engines. People finding the content that people generated or created on Spectrum, on Google or Bing or whatever.
Okay, so I guess it's React and maybe like some kind of server-side rendered React version.
Yes. So our architecture-wise, the front-end was entirely a React front-end that was server-side rendered by a server dynamically for every single request, for every single user, which was hardish to scale. I think if I would do it again, I'd slightly change the architecture to sort of pre-build the public pages and then sort of dynamically load in any user-specific data, because the only thing that really needs to be server-side rendered is all the data that we want Google to index, which is not the authenticated version, but the public version, right? So all of the authenticated stuff, we should have really been lazy loading. But anyways, it worked out fine. It was basically a server-side rendered React app based on a GraphQL API. And we had a bunch of background workers that did a bunch of jobs, like processing notifications, sending push notifications, sending emails, computing various statistics, stuff like that.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to people that have an idea, pretty much like myself, like mentorcv.com, but haven't actually dedicated a whole bunch of time to sit and get it to work?
What I learned since then is that really the most important thing is shipping something really quickly. Because if you're building a startup, you need to build something that is immediately useful, no matter how shitty it is. And that sounds really stupid, and it sort of goes counter to anything engineers ever think about. But you really want to write the least amount of code possible. Ideally, you don't want to write any code. And I say this advice having never actually taken it because I love writing code. So any new idea I have, I immediately jump into writing code. But really, that's the wrong idea if you're trying to be, if you're trying to make money in the living, the best thing you can do is not write any code, hook up an Airtable form to whatever, and then validate your idea immediately. Because if you're building something that people want, they're going to want it no matter how shitty it is. And if they don't want it, it's not going to be because it's shitty. It's going to be because you're not solving a problem that's valuable enough. So you should just focus on something else, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. What's Airtable?
It's just an example. Airtable is this Google Sheets alternative. You could also use Google Sheets. Basically, or like Google Forms. Anything that lets you hook up some kind of logic to some data input and then solve a user's problem. There's a whole no-code movement out there. Just Google no code and you'll find a bunch of resources on building stuff without writing any code. And it's absolutely crazy what you can do. There's platforms that let you create native apps from scratch in like 10 minutes and then deploy them to the App Store. It is absolutely incredible. I personally hate them because I love writing code, right? Like the thing I enjoy in life is writing code. So every single time I have a new idea, the first thing I do is writing code, which is the exact wrong approach, right? Like that's completely incorrect. In terms of, there's a dissonance there, right? My goal is to be a bootstrap founder now. I want to make passive money, like you said. I want to have some kind of passive income. That goal doesn't at all work with what I'm really good at and what I enjoy doing, which is kind of this dissonance there where I start writing code, even though really I should be validating my idea by shipping it as quickly as possible, which is something I'm working on. It's not that easy for me just because I love writing code. We'll see. Maybe a year from now, things will be different, but yeah.
I just discovered this term on Google called no code development. That's like a dry shower or something like that, you know? No code development.
Yeah, but people build incredible stuff with this no code like movement. You just look that up. I'm not too deep into it. Like I said, I love writing code, but it's absolutely incredible what you can do without actually writing any code.
Yeah. Yeah, I had an idea that I bought a domain that I haven't actually built something with, but it was like kind of travel and event space. But now it's like, that might wait for a bit, you know?
Yeah. Classic first step. Buy the solid domain name, then never do anything with it. I probably have like 20 domain names that I keep paying for every year because I'm like, yeah, I might still build that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was syncmytravel.com or syncyourtravel.com. I can't remember. I think it's Sync Your Travel, but I think Sync My Travel sounds better. Let me check. I wonder if that's available.
And buying the next domain.
Yeah, buy it. Just let it sit there for a few years. I bought NikosGetsTheCandice.com for 10 years about a year ago because I decided I was getting tired of creating websites, you know, like NikosCode.com, QuantumJS.com, and then just eventually moving off it. And I thought, okay, I'll buy something that I won't ever get rid of and I'll just put my stuff on there.
Yeah, that makes total sense, honestly.
Cool. So what are you up to these days? Because now you're probably not that busy as compared to when you were doing your startup.
At Gatsby, I'm working on the officially we call it the themes team, which Gatsby is the static site generator for React, in case you don't know. And as part of that, we have Gatsby themes, which is a way for people to use a shared functionality, right? And so our team is responsible for themes, but also we're building a bunch of other experimental projects outside of Gatsby core that we might eventually integrate. So one of the ones is Blocks UI, which is a visual editor for React apps that we will probably eventually turn into a page builder of some sort. And then something I'm personally working on right now is Gatsby Admin, which will sort of be the equivalent of WordPress Admin or PHP My Admin, but for Gatsby websites, where you can configure your Gatsby site without having to touch any code, and install plugins and install themes and try them out and all these things.
I see. So Gatsby is a static site generator.
Yes.
How does it handle state then?
Well, so here's the thing. State only ever happens based on user input, right? So it's a React app that is then statically rendered. and then rehydrate it on the client, which means if your users do anything, it's going to be just a normal React app. But the initial render is a statically rendered page. It's mostly used for newspapers or blogs or things like that right now. However, basically CMS-driven websites is sort of the main use case right now. However, really, as soon as we can get build times low enough, you could practically build any app as a static page, which means it would never go down. It would always be up. It would always be super fast. And it would probably be a pretty simple architecture overall. That's sort of my dream, personally. I wish we could have built Spectrum as a static site, which makes no sense if you think about it because it's a chat app. But if you can generate, like, imagine somebody sends a message. We can display that message immediately, just dynamically on the client. And then imagine if you could use that input of the new message to kick off a build process. If that build process completes within, say, a second, or maybe even 5 seconds, right? That's totally fine. Then every public user of the site can get a static page that was built ahead of time with the new message within, you know, a second. Assuming builds and deploys together take less than 5 seconds or so. That practically opens up 95% of all apps ever to be static websites, which means they're much more scalable because they're just static pages. They're much more performant because users are just downloading HTML sites from the edge, right? Like you're essentially removing the entire database scaling issues from any website ever. In fact, that's sort of what people are starting to do now with WordPress. They're using WordPress as an API and a CMS, and then they're building Gatsby sites that sit in front of the WordPress API, which just get rebuilt whenever the content in WordPress changes, which means your WordPress, under air quotes, WordPress website never goes down because it's no longer dynamic. You can't hit the database limit. You can't hit a connection limit. You can't do anything. And it's on every single edge. It's your website is deployed to like 200, depending on which CDN you use, 150 or 200 locations all around the world, which means even if your users are somewhere in completely different from where you are, your website is going to load in 100 milliseconds for them, right? Which is absolutely incredible. It essentially removes the entire how do we deploy a database globally problem by just not deploying a database globally, but instead building everything statically and then deploying that globally. For example, Fastly is a really good CDN that can deploy to their 150 locations in literally 100 milliseconds. So if you have a new HTML page, you can tell Fastly about it, and within 150 milliseconds, everybody everywhere around the world will be able to access it, which is mind-blowing.
That's crazy.
I'm not sure if that made any sense. There was a bunch of, like, this is a bunch of internal context that I have. If something didn't make sense, just let me clarify.
So say you have this not scalable database, you have this fast deploying CDN static site builder. If somebody makes a change somewhere in the world, they still have to access the database somehow, right?
Yes. So the database is essentially a write store. You write to it, and then your site gets rebuilt, which accesses the database once, and then it just gets deployed statically everywhere around the world. Whereas with a dynamic website, every single time anybody loads any page, minus caching and some other hairy stuff, your database gets accessed and read for the fresh data.
Right.
Okay. Does that differentiation sort of make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
So for example, for this podcast, a static site would totally make sense, right? Because even if you're publishing a podcast a day, and even if deploys take 5 minutes every time, that's not that big of a deal, right? But the upside of that is that your website loads super quickly for everybody everywhere around the world. People can open your website within 200, 500 milliseconds, no matter where they are. Right now, build times are still too slow to do it for every single application. The build times right now, the product that Gatsby sells, the way Gatsby makes money is that we have this Gatsby Cloud product, which essentially just builds Gatsby websites really, really, really quickly. And so you can have a website with 100,000 pages and it'll build in 5 minutes, right? Which is absolutely incredible. And so what we're working on now is incremental builds, which means only ever the pages get rebuilt that actually have data change. So if you upload a new podcast, the only pages that get rebuilt are the new page for the podcast that you just uploaded and the homepage with the list of all podcasts. And all the other pages that didn't change because the new podcast didn't change or any of the old podcasts that were sites don't get rebuilt, which means we could get we're going to get build times down to less than 10 seconds, ideally even less than 5 seconds. That's sort of the top level company goal. And once that happens, if I can build practically any kind of app as a static site, because if builds are 5 seconds long, there's very few apps where 5 seconds is too long of a waiting time for everybody else to see the fresh data, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure. Fascinating. My first foray into static sites was it was PHP back in the day, but I was using Zapper, which is Svelte's static site. It's the back end to pre-render Svelte apps, but there's a static export that it can do, and I was using I was hosting on Netlify, but I was using Firebase for the authentication layer, and it was just too hard trying to get this every static site page to have this Firebase in it, and then I just basically went full SPA. But it would be nice to get back into server-side rendering stuff at some point.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of work to be done for that ideal scenario, utopia. I would almost call it a utopia to be true, but it's literally our goal, and it's probably going to happen within a year, maybe two. Like, we're going to make this happen pretty soon, which is that's mind-blowing to me. I had no idea that was even a possibility before I joined Gatsby, but it makes so much sense. And I wish when we built Spectrum, I had that ability, because I would have totally architected Spectrum that way. Like, that's just ideal. No more scaling problems, no issues with anything. It just works everywhere around the world, and it's super fast and super performant.
Yeah, hard to keep up with all this stuff though. So everything sort of went so full circle. You started off with static sites and PHP, and went to SPAs, and everyone excited about that, and RESTful services. Now it's going back to static sites.
Yeah, yeah, it's weird.
Maybe we'll go back to using Dreamweaver.
you're joking, but what, essentially we're building a Dreamweaver, but for React apps. That's essentially also what we're working on. It's called Blocks. It doesn't quite work. So here's the interesting thing about Blocks. Blocks is this page builder, right? If you've ever used Wix or Webflow or Dreamweaver even, it's the same thing. But you're working with components. So you have a list of React components. These are your own React components. You can use any React component you want. And then you can drag and drop it around the page, and you can change whatever content you want. And then when you press save, it actually writes that out to a file as JSX. Which means you're literally live editing your code visually with drag and drop, which is not something that any page builder before has ever done. If you've ever used Webflow or Wix or anything, they don't let you edit the code, right? They have their own representation under the hood, sort of like an AST, I guess, that is then rendered to HTML and CSS on a request. And so the best you're going to get is the generated HTML and CSS, but that's totally not what you want, because you're not building a large website and plugging together every single page manually, right? Like, you're using components. And so Blocks lets you actually drag and drop and visually edit your React apps with the components, which is super powerful. It's a little bit new right now. It's in a very alpha state, but over the next year, we're going to solidify that and turn it into an actually usable page builder / visual editor for your React apps. So essentially, a bunch of exciting things are happening that I can't wait to actually have and share and like be stable to use. Because once all of this comes together, it's going to be incredible.
So that page builder uses the actual rendered CSS component as it would in a normal page?
Yes, it's literally your React components. It just renders your page, and then you can drag and drop around, and it'll edit your code.
Right. I've never actually seen component libraries done properly so that people actually use them in companies. Like, they have whole teams for all it, you know.
That's another thing. So I do these live stream chats now where I talk to really smart people for an hour, kind of like a podcast, except more informal and more live. And recently I had a chat with Siddharth, who works at Code Sandbox right now and used to work at Auth0 on the design systems team. And he's building this super interesting new component library called React UI, which is really not meant to be a component library. It's more like a skeleton kind of thing where you get layout components and you get a themable set of base components that you're meant to extend yourself based on the CSS and JS framework that they use. And it's really exciting. I think the one thing that's been bugging me in React all this time is it's not that we need another button, right? Like, I don't need another component library with a button. I can make my own buttons, right? Like, that's fine. What I really want is a solid abstraction for layout, because how many different layouts are there, right? Like, React apps have maybe, you can cover 90% of React apps with maybe 20 different layouts. And I think that's maybe even too much, right? Like, you have a sidebar, you have a main area, or you might have a content area, right? You're going to have a navbar, you're going to have a footer. That's it, right? Every single React app has very similar layouts, just plugged together slightly differently. And I've been waiting for this solid abstraction for layouts to happen, and it hasn't really happened. And the thing is, once we actually get FlexGap, I think we're going to be in a really good spot, because CSS, between Flexbox with FlexGap and CSS Grid, allows us to build pretty much any layout in a super neat and easy way, which is very exciting to me.
Yeah.
So this podcast network, it was they had 9 podcasts. Is this, you had 2 guys making 9 podcasts, or they had some other system around that?
No, so they essentially they also do 3 podcasts, I think, but they've now downscaled to 1. And the other 8 podcasts are from other people, and they essentially take care of the editing, they take care of the sharing, they take care of the social media, they take care of everything else. So it's a podcast recorder. You just record your podcast, you send it to them, and they do everything else for you.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
And they organize sponsors and, you know, that kind of thing. It's called Spec FM. There's a bunch of good podcasts on there. The one that Brian and Bryn did and still do is called Design Details, which is one of the most famous design podcasts, which sort of started this whole podcast network thing. And now they've got the React podcast. They've got a bunch of different ones on there.
Do you have a podcast?
I don't. I've thought about creating one because I really like talking to smart people like you. It's just a really good excuse to talk to really smart people,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I'm not sure. I might eventually make one. Right now I'm doing these, like I said, I'm experimenting with these live stream chats where essentially I just have a Zoom chat with somebody and then live stream that to an audience. And it's similar to a podcast, but a little bit more informal, where we're sort of debating at a high level, right? Like, these are people that I look up to and whose ideas I respect and want to talk about. And so I debate with them on a high level about what they're doing and why they're doing it and why they're not doing it any other way, which I think might be interesting. I could turn it into a podcast, but honestly, that will make it so much more work. Like, I don't want to be editing audio files right now. I don't have time to do that.
I've almost got the editing process down to the same amount of time it takes to record it. Well, it takes me about an hour to edit something. I mean, it used to take me about 20 to 25 minutes to get the audio devices set up, but now I just, like, I'm used to all the quirks. I just plug in the USB-C mic, sort up the multi-track recording on the Mac, and then I'm ready to go. I've just done it so many times. That's almost 100 episodes now. But it is a very slow build. But you gotta know why you want to do the podcast.
So why did you start? What keeps you motivated 100 episodes in? Why do you record
the podcast? Well, iPod faded on both my podcasts for about 9 months, and I was even thinking of, like, stopping it, because, like, why am I paying Simplecast, you know, several hundred a year just to have this thing that I'm not using? So actually, it was Ken Howard that actually gave me the idea to start Learn With Us. He was just basically chatting to me one day and says, I thought about doing a podcast, you want to try it? And I says, yes, let's do it. So we did that. But yeah, I mean, Learn With Us is just gives me, you know, it gives me great opportunity to talk to people that I wouldn't normally get a chance to talk to for extended periods of time. Also, it did give me a bit of sponsorship income with Manning. So, and another one, Influencers Cafe, I wanted to have just a sort of free-for-all that I'd just be able to explore intellectually any subject I was interested in and capture conversations for posterity, my own posterity, I guess, so I can listen to stuff.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's I think everybody, there's not like, I don't have like a minimum like social influencing that you got to have to come on the show. I mean, I could talk to somebody that works, I mean, I'm interested in finding out about, I'm looking to, for somebody that works at McDonald's to come on the show because I want to find out what it's like to work as a McDonald's employee.
That's a really good idea, actually. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's this is interesting. I mean, if all you have is multimillionaires coming on that have like this lifestyle, and that's for me is like, if that's all you do, that for me is boring, you know?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I know what you mean. I actually think, you know, there's this idea that every person has a story, right? Everybody has a story to tell, and everybody has something interesting to say, and I think that's really true. The more people you can talk to, the more inputs you get, the more you're going to learn, and the more you're going to be open to new things, and the more you're going to be creative and thus successful eventually, right? Like, that's a pretty strong belief that I have, that the more diverse your friend group and the more diverse group of people you talk to, the higher is the chance of stumbling upon something that is going to change your life.
Sure. Really. I mean, I even just like have my friends come on quite a lot. So like old school friends, people I've not seen a lot, people, some youth groups that I've not talked to in years, but it's just nice to be able to capture it in time. And then for our reason, I want to listen to it again. I can just fire up the podcast.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like that a lot, actually. Now you're making me want to start a podcast.
You should. I mean, you don't have to spend money on hosting. You can do like Anchor, which is like, I think they offer free services, but I wanted more control over the distribution and the show, so that's why I pay for Simplecast.
Yeah, right, that makes sense.
But there is, the barrier to entry is pretty much zero, but there is a lot of pod fading out there. So you have a podcast that'll come on, they'll do like 20 episodes and then they'll just stop and that'll be it. That's why there's so many. It seems like there's a lot of podcasts out there, but a lot of them just like they lose that drive. You've got to have a long-term drive to be able to, if you have a goal in a podcast, so if you want to make a living from it, then you got to like, if you're doing it just for the money, don't do it because you'll never get there. You got to actually enjoy the process.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. That's awesome.
You also got to know your target audience. So that's, in a sense, why I separated Influencers Cafe from Learn With Us. So Learn With Us, I've got a target audience there. It is growing. Met of listeners that listen to the show. It's quite interesting to watch. And actually, I think most of the people are actually from America. It's amazing.
Really?
Yeah. And on the Influencers one, it's mostly UK people.
Really?
Yeah.
That's super curious. Huh.
Yeah, I think,
do you think that's mainly, is it mainly like the Silicon Valley? Because it's very tech focused, right? Is it mainly like people from California, or is it just all over America?
It's pretty much all over America, but there's quite a large concentration in Silicon Valley.
That's incredible. Super interesting.
But the guests are not all American. There's a lot of European people on the show.
Yeah.
Huh. Whereas a lot of the guests that come on Influencers Cafe are American, so I think the Americans maybe get tired of listening to Americans or something.
Yeah, it's possible. Get tired of just always listening to Americans, so you want to listen to some Europeans.
Yeah, I mean,
that's super interesting. It's weird that they're so different.
Yeah, I guess. Curious. I mean, I don't think, if I was listening to another Scotsman on a podcast, I probably wouldn't bother because I can go up there and talk to them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay, well, what you plan for today then?
Well, this morning I went for a run and then I did a Zoom group workout with some friends. We just got on Zoom. We all did the same cardio workout. And now I'm doing this podcast, and afterwards I'm going to be working on publishing the first RFC for Gatsby Admin. That's sort of my big goal for the day, I guess.
Yeah, good buddy. Cool. Anything else you want to talk to our guests about before we wrap it up?
No, I think that was a great, great mixture of things. I hope it was interesting for people.
It was fascinating. Yeah, it's going to inspire me to get on with this, my own startups better.
You should. Good luck. Keep me in the loop with that.
Yeah, will do, buddy. Yeah. Okay, that was Max Stoiber from Austria. And you can, where can people find you?
Mostly everywhere at MXSTBR, which sounds really complicated, but it's just my name without vowels. So if you remember Max Stoiber, just take out all the vowels, you get MXSTBR. I'm that on Twitter, Instagram, GitHub, everywhere the social networks. I have that handle. Come follow me. And yeah, that's really it.
Yeah, if you go to his GitHub, you'll see that he has 44 times the amount of followers as me. 4.5, that's a lot of followers.
I calculated half a year to a year ago, I want to say, all of my open source projects together have a grand total of probably had a grand total of 75,000 stars. And I want to cross the 100,000 star mark in total. We'll see if that actually happens.
Is there like a constant ratio between Twitter followers and, say, GitHub followers?
No, not really. The GitHub followers are really useless, so nobody really uses GitHub following. Because following somebody on GitHub doesn't actually do anything. It doesn't let you do it. You know what I mean? Like, it's completely useless. So that there isn't really many people on GitHub that follow other people. So no, not really. There's a more direct correlation between Twitter followers and GitHub stars. If you have a popular open source project, lots of people will follow you in most cases. But even that is a little bit of a wonky correlation. It doesn't work out one-to-one.
Cool. Okay, well, thank you, my listener, for joining me and Max. We hope you found it interesting. We were motivated to start a startup and podcast and other things, I guess. So we'll see you again whenever I can be bothered to upload another episode. How about that one?
Yeah, nice. I like it.
See you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on.